Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Most Notorious, the 1912 shipwreck of Chicago's famed Christmas tree ship.
Well, first of all, they were overcrowded with evergreen trees. The captain had built a special housing in the middle of the deck to house some more Christmas trees. And so for them to sail the ship, these men had to climb over that housing and, to get from the front of the ship to the back of the ship, or to maneuver or work any of the sails or any of the lines on board. And they had difficulty doing that. But what probably happened was that the ship started leaking.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious podcast. Merry Christmas. Happy whatever you find happy in this season of nostalgia, celebration, giving, and reflection. I am very pleased to have as my guests today Chris Cole and Joan Forsberg. They are well-known maritime historians, scuba divers, lecturers, photographers, and videographers. They are a husband and wife team who love to explore shipwrecks, especially Great Lakes shipwrecks. They are the producers of 16 documentaries and 19 books, including the one they are here to talk about today. It is called The Christmas Tree Ship. Great to have you both on. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes, we're very happy to chat with you, Eric.
So I'd love to know where your interest in maritime history started, and what is it about the Great Lakes that is especially appealing to you?
Well, I'll start by saying that I've always been interested in ships, moving on the water on ships. Even as a child, my parents took me across the Atlantic Ocean on ocean liners a couple of times. And I do remember at the age of 14 photographing icebergs in the North Atlantic and the lifeboats on board our ocean liner. And so that's probably where it started for me. But I also was fascinated by stories about shipwrecks. In fact, the very first book I ever read was about a shipwrecked sailor. It was a book called Robinson Crusoe, and I read that when I was in grade two. And it's been with me ever since, quite an influence in my life. And of course, I had friends years ago when I was in my 20s who were also interested in doing a lot of snorkeling and swimming, and they got into scuba diving at about the same time I did. They encouraged me to join them, so I did. And what I found intriguing is that there was so little information about Great Lakes shipwrecks, and shipwrecks in the Great Lakes is about all that scuba divers have to dive on. We don't have colorful coral reefs or rainbow-hued fish or anything like that, or warm water for that matter, but we do have the best preserved shipwrecks in the world.
When I was a child, my family lived near the ocean in New York, and I loved the sea. In fact, my mother thought I was more fish than girl, because if we would go to the beach, I would go in the water and not come out until I absolutely had to. I loved it. I loved everything about it. And then when I moved to the Great Lakes area, and the Great Lakes were large enough to almost seem as though they were the ocean, but they didn't have things that the ocean had in them, the coral and the fish and all of that wonderful underwater marine life. But to my astonishment, when I met Chris, I suddenly realized, you know what? I am a ship nut. I love ships. And so taking that love of ships that I've always had, and of course, and I have a degree in history, well, you marry those two things and you get maritime history. And of course, if it's the Great Lakes, all too frequently, it means shipwrecks. So there you are.
So what makes Great Lakes shipwrecks more preserved than other shipwrecks? And why are there so many shipwrecks on the Great Lakes?
Well, for one thing, the very cold, fresh waters are the main factor, I would say. In salt water, you have wood-destroying creatures that within a year, any wooden vessel that isn't buried in the sand would be eaten by teredo worms or items like that. And in the Great Lakes, we don't have that sort of thing. Because it's cold, fresh water, it helps preserve the wood. And there are shipwrecks that have been underwater for 150 years that look as though if you could get them to the surface, they could sail away on their own. They're that intact. And
also the salt water corrodes steel. If you've seen pictures of Titanic, it looks like it's dissolving. It's something Dr. Ballard called rusticles forming. And you don't have that in the Great Lakes because it's fresh water. So it preserves wooden wrecks as well as steel wrecks. And so the wonderful thing for us is that we can really see exactly how people lived 150 years ago, 100 years ago, as recorded on these shipwrecks. They are underwater museums.
I think most people today are totally unaware, even the people that live in the Great Lakes, are totally unaware of the massive maritime history associated with the Great Lakes. At the height of the number of vessels sailing the fresh waters of the Great Lakes, and that would have been the 1870s and 1880s, we had nearly 2,000 ships on these waters. And of course, that's just in any given year, you know. And they came and went. They sank. They got moved to the East Coast. They got abandoned, and there were a lot of vessels that were built on the Great Lakes. And you know, for that reason, we have more than 6,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. And a lot of them got there, well, most of them, I'd say, sank because of bad weather. We've all heard about the notorious gales of November. So November was always the worst month on the Great Lakes for bad weather, and a lot of ships foundered during that month. Of course, there were also collisions, because approaching a harbor, a big harbor like Chicago, the ships would be in pretty close proximity to one another. And if it was nighttime or foggy or rainy or a blizzard going on, they quite often collided with one another. Other factors would have been stranding on the shoreline, you know, the wind blowing ships onto a shore, and then they would break up on the shoreline. Ships also burned. The early steamers exploded because of somebody not keeping an eye on the pressure in the boiler. And so there were a number of reasons for so many ships being destroyed in the Great Lakes.
There was so much shipping on the Great Lakes. And in the days before there were highways and trucks, well, ships were the main mode of transportation of goods, as well as people. And so when you have a lot of shipping, a lot of traffic, you have accidents of one kind or another, just like on our highways today. So that also was a huge factor, especially outside a busy harbor like Chicago, where the shipping traffic was just overwhelming. And that's why right outside Chicago, you have so many shipwrecks.
So you've spent a lot of time on the Great Lakes, poking around. Is there a ship that is especially desirable for explorers? One you would like to find? A holy grail of Great Lakes ships?
Well, there are certainly shipwrecks, that have not yet been found. Like the very first ship on the Upper Great Lakes was built in the year 1679 by the explorer La Salle. And that shipwreck, on its way back on the return leg of its maiden voyage, disappeared with a valuable cargo of furs and all of its six crew members. And it hasn't been found yet. Well, we haven't got enough evidence anyway to prove that it's been located yet. There have been claims made, more than 20 of them in the last 150 years of that shipwreck having been found. But almost all of them have proven to be wrong. A couple of them are still maybe, but we haven't got the smoking gun evidence yet for the wreck of the Griffin. The most recent shipwreck in the Great Lakes is perhaps the most famous one that the world knows about, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald in Lake Superior. And it's deep, very deep. It's in 529 feet of Lake Superior water. And only two scuba divers have ever visited it. They prepared, they trained for months. They spent 8 minutes on the shipwreck in total darkness. They had underwater lights with them, of course. And then they spent 3 hours coming back up to the surface, and they have no desire to do it again.
What you have so many times is a mystery surrounding a shipwreck. You know, sometimes we just don't know exactly why it sank. The Edmund Fitzgerald was traveling certainly through a terrible storm. And we know where it is, and we've seen photographs of it. And, of course, we know it broke apart. It split in half, and that would certainly kill any freighter. But the Griffin, we're not quite sure why exactly it sank, although it did seem to head straight into a storm. But where it sank and what happened to the crew precisely, all of that is a mystery, and people love a mystery. So that's those kind of ships that we don't know exactly and precisely what happened to them, that's exciting to learn about.
You write in your book about the history and evolution of the Christmas tree. And for many people, their first exposure to Christmas trees started with an illustration. Right, in the 1848 London Illustrated News.
Okay, well, let's go back even earlier. Let's go back to the early 1600s when, according to tradition, Martin Luther in Germany set up the first Christmas tree with lighted candles on it, set it up in his residence, his home. With lighted candles and fruit and candies and things like that. You know, they didn't have any fancy Christmas tree ornaments back then. But that seems to have caught on, in Germany at least. And it finally did catch on in surrounding countries in the early 1800s. like in Austria and Denmark and Sweden and France. In England, it took a little longer. It didn't catch on until the 1840s. Queen Victoria, young Queen Victoria, had married a German prince, and he brought his tradition of setting up a Christmas tree to England with him, and she liked the idea. And so they, starting in the early 1840s, they set up a Christmas tree with, again, with fruit and candy and real candles in the Royal Palace in London. And finally, in the year 1848, there was a large picture, not a photograph, but a drawing of Queen Victoria and her husband Albert and several of their children around a Christmas tree. It was a full-page drawing that appeared in a very popular London newspaper at that time, London Illustrated News, and it caught on with the public. So starting in 1848, after 1848, after the appearance of that drawing, people thought, well, why don't we do that? Why don't we get an evergreen tree and put it up in our house to celebrate Christmas with? And that's how that happened. It took a little longer to get to the North America. Europeans brought it with them, quite frankly, the Germans and the Scandinavians. But it wasn't until after the Civil War, 1860s, that the idea of a Christmas tree in a family home became popular. And it started out being a large tree being displayed in a church or a school or some other similar institution, that the idea finally caught on with people that they could have a much smaller version of that huge tree in that public place in their own home. And they started doing that pretty extensively by the late 1800s. And that's what the main reason was for the development of Christmas tree ships. Ships that brought Christmas trees at the end of the year, the last run of the year in November, down to places that lacked evergreen trees, such as the prairie ports of Chicago and Milwaukee. That's the start of the prairies. And so they had a hard time finding evergreen trees in that area. So they had ships bring them down, and later train loads bring them down to those big cities.
So the Christmas tree ship, the ship's name was the Rouse Simmons. Would you tell us about its background, how it was used to deliver Christmas trees, and a bit about its colorful captain as well?
The Rouse Simmons was actually one of many Christmas tree ships, but for some reason, and people love a colorful story, Captain Santa is what Captain Herman Schunemann became known as, because when he brought his load of Christmas trees to the Clark Street dock in Chicago every year, usually at the end of November, after having made that treacherous run from the North Woods of Michigan and Wisconsin, with his load of Christmas trees, he had his schooner decorated. There was a Christmas tree on top of the mast. There was lights, and his wonderful family made wreaths, and it was just such a festive event that so many families in Chicago looked forward to. But it was no means the only Christmas tree. It was the most famous Christmas tree ship. His older brother had been running Christmas tree ships for many years, and he and his ship also went down in a treacherous storm in Lake Michigan in 1898. August Schunemann went down with the S. Tall, which was the name of his ship. Now, one of the things that the Schunemann brothers and so many other Christmas tree ship captains did was they used old broken down ships. These were not brand spanking new. They were old. They were really near the end of their life. So what they had been used for all year long was the lumber trade. They were lumber carriers. And then the last trip of the year was to bring Christmas trees. And that would be the end of their season, because by then the lakes were too treacherous. Ice was starting to move in, and the lumber trade was done for the year. But that last run with Christmas trees was so profitable for them that it was worth the risk.
Yeah, the Rouse Simmons itself was built in Kenosha, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in 1868 by a man who lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin, not that far away. And it was built specifically for the lumber trade, as Joan mentioned, as were so many other vessels at that time on Lake Michigan, because Chicago, basically, and the other big cities along the shoreline, they needed lumber. They were building houses and buildings galore out of wood. So it was very common for 3/4 of the vessels coming into Chicago Harbor to be carrying lumber back in the 1870s. So the Rouse Simmons was a 3-masted schooner, 127 feet long, and it spent by far most of its life carrying lumber, except, as Joan mentioned, the last 3 years of its life, namely 1910, 1911, and 1912, for the last run of the season, it carried Christmas trees. And yet it carried them for only 3 years, and yet it's the most famous of all the Christmas tree carrying ships in the history of the Great Lakes.
Where in Chicago did they dock and set up shop?
It was right by the Clark Street Bridge, right in the Chicago River. And it was quite an event. I mean, it must have been really, really exciting for Chicagoans to see this 3-masted schooner with lights and Christmas trees all over it coming right up the Chicago River, right to the dock. And they were all waiting there, excited and happy. It must have been quite an event.
You have to remember that just a few years earlier, in 1909, the city fathers of Chicago decided that the city was too crowded with ships. The river, Chicago River, was too crowded with ships. So they moved the harbor down to Calumet, a few miles to the south. And so suddenly there was very little activity going on the Chicago River. And especially also by 1910, the first year that the Rouse Simmons was used as a Christmas tree ship, there were very few schooners left in the sailing on the Great Lakes in any business, lumber business or Christmas tree ship business. And so the sight of a sailing vessel had become somewhat of a rare sight by 1910 on the Great Lakes. So for the sake of tradition, people loved going down to the Clark Street Bridge, walking on board the schooner, the Rouse Simmons, and buying a Christmas tree directly from Hermann Scheunemann, the captain of the vessel.
We will be back in a few moments.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did, because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
And we have returned. So it was a family tradition for the Schunemann family, and a family tradition for many, many Chicagoans.
You know, it was a family story for Chicagoans to buy the trees there, but they were being provided by a family, the captain and his wife and three daughters. They were all there on the Rouse Simmons, all, you know, selling the trees and creating the wreaths and the boughs and all of the other evergreen decorations. And so it just was, everyone was in such good spirits and so happy. And it heralded the beginning of the Christmas season. And this, for all of these newly arrived immigrants and children of immigrants and the families of immigrants, this meant a lot to them because there were no trees. They couldn't go out in the woods and cut a tree because there weren't any woods right there.
Okay, we also have to remember that this was probably the most profitable project for any Christmas tree ship. That last run of the season sometimes made as much money for the ship owner as hauling all that lumber did throughout the spring, summer, and early fall. So it turned out to be a very profitable thing, too, for the Schunemanns. And quite often, that was the reason they were still able to, you know, own their house, for example, and live a relatively comfortable lifestyle, because they became so popular with their Christmas tree ship in Chicago Harbor.
And part of the reason they became so popular was the personality of Herman Schunemann. Mm-hmm. He was jovial, he was happy, and he wore a Santa hat, and he could have just sold the trees as a simple business transaction, but he did not do that. He made it an event, a happy Christmas season event, and everyone loved that about him. He was fun to be with.
So tell us about November 23rd, 1912, the terrible storm, blizzard, that the Rouse Simmons had the misfortune of meeting face-to-face on Lake Michigan.
Well, Captain Schunemann took the Rouse Simmons to the northern part of Lake Michigan on October 3rd, 1912, and then for the next 7 weeks, he and his crew members cut down Christmas trees in that northern part of the state of Michigan. And they loaded them onto the ship. In fact, they cut so many that they couldn't get them all onto the ship. He had to send a few of them down by train from the far north reaches of Michigan. And he decided to leave the harbor up there in near Manistique, Michigan, on November 22nd, which is a Friday. And, of course, there's a superstition that no ship should leave a harbor on a Friday because it'll run into bad luck. Well, I guess maybe they lost track of the days of the week while they were cutting lumber up there, or cutting trees, rather, up there. And they left on a Friday and ran into a normally it was a three-day trip down to a three-day sail down to Chicago. But on the second day, they were off Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and they were battling a very severe storm that they had hoped to outrun, but they didn't, they couldn't. And that's where they ran into problems. Life-saving crews on shore could see them through their telescopes. They were flying a flag at half-mast, meaning it was a distress situation for them. And well, they disappeared in a blizzard, basically.
Yeah, the life-saving crews couldn't get to them because the first life-saving crew that saw the ship, they only had rowboats. So they couldn't make it through the very, very ferocious waters. And then the next life-saving crew that tried to go out there, they had motorboats, but they couldn't find the ship. So that's why either the ship had gone down between those two cities, Kewaunee and Two Rivers, or it was just in a different location when that second life-saving group tried to go out and find it and never did find it. And sad to say, nobody was ever recovered from that ship. It went down in such a terrible storm that the bodies were all lost, and that just has no, there's no closure for the families of those crew.
How many people were aboard the ship?
Well, that's been debated. There was Captain Schoeneman and his eight sailors, his eight hired crew. We know that much, but apparently another seven or eight lumberjacks from the North Woods thought they, you know, they asked if they could hitch a ride down to Chicago with the Rouse on board the Rouse Simmons. And Captain Schoeneman apparently said yes, because they did leave northern Michigan, but they were never seen again. And we have very few names, only the names of the crew and the captain. But we don't know any of the lumberjacks that were on board. There were no records kept of them leaving. So there's probably the most accurate numbers that there were probably 15 or 16 people on board the Rouse Simmons when it sank and was lost with all hands.
And Captain Schoeneman's family was not on the Rouse Simmons, right?
Correct. His wife and daughters were back in Chicago awaiting his arrival and readying everything so that they would all be ready to sell the trees and the wreaths and so on. And they waited and waited and waited. And Barbara Schoeneman tried so hard not to give up hope. She waited and waited, and it was almost 2 weeks before she really did acknowledge that the ship would never arrive, that her husband was lost. But to her credit, what she and her daughters did was really unthinkable in those days, days before women had the vote and virtually never worked outside the home. She determined to continue on the tradition to sell Christmas trees that year. And when the train arrived with the shipment of Christmas trees, she hired a schooner and she sold trees that year from that Clark Street dock, just as they had planned. And of course, Chicagoans all knew the Rouse Simmons was lost. But there was the brave widow and her three daughters carrying on anyway. Well, of course, there was an outpouring of support and love for these women. And it just, it continued for years that she was determined to continue on the tradition as he would have wanted her to, no matter what it took. And her oldest daughter, Elsie, became a media darling. She really went after that publicity. She had pictures taken of herself at the wheel of a schooner, and that they kind of maybe fudged the truth a little bit, made it sound like the women themselves were skippering the schooners to bring them, which wasn't quite true. But it made for a wonderful, romantic, heroic story. But they did sell trees, and they carried on the tradition for many, many years, more than 20 years after the loss of the captain.
Yeah, the widow, Barbara Shinneman, died in 1933, and her daughters, who were all married by that time, carried on for another couple of years, but they had young families, and it was the middle of the Depression, so they stopped selling Christmas trees as a family business in, I believe it was 1935, but they did maintain it for as Joan pointed out, for more than two decades. And when Barbara Shinneman passed away, she was buried in a Chicago cemetery, and her headstone has her name and her husband's name, even though his body was never found. And there is a silhouette, a drawing of a Christmas tree between their two names as kind of a symbol of what the family did for not just business, but also for pleasure.
So it's, of course, impossible to know exactly what the crew experienced without survivors. But from the best of your understanding, what would it have been like to be on the Rouse Simmons as it was being battered by this blizzard?
Well, they would have had problems because of not just the violent nature of the storm, but because of the old age of the ship they were on. The Rouse Simmons was 43 years old by that time, and even in the fresh waters of the Great Lakes, that's considered very old. Very rarely did a ship, even a wooden one, last for 40 years on the Great Lakes. But first of all, they were overcrowded with evergreen trees. The captain had built a special housing in the middle of the deck to house some more Christmas trees, and so for them to sail the ship, these men had to climb over that housing and to get to from the front of the ship to the back of the ship, or to maneuver or work any of the sails or any of the lines on board. They had difficulty doing that. But what probably happened was that the ship started leaking. The hull would not have been solid anymore, and all it had to do was spring one plank, and water would have started coming in, and they would have started settling slowly to the bottom. One observer from the shoreline said that they seemed to be, looking through a telescope, he said the ship seemed to be heeled over a little too far to one side. So we're not quite sure what exactly happened there. The conjecture is that housing that held a lot of evergreen trees on the deck of the Rouse Simmons was broken off and washed away by the storm. And the regular pilot house housing on the vessel was also washed away. It's not on the shipwreck. The masts are all there, so although they broke off when the ship hit the bottom of Lake Michigan, but so they weren't demasted or anything like that during the storm, but they probably just foundered. They couldn't do anything. They had one little rowboat on board, and it would probably not have held even three or four people safely under those conditions of the storm. So it was pretty much a losing proposition to try to save the ship or themselves.
One of the things that was probably happening was ice was building up on the ship, because they were in a virtually a blizzard, And the ice added to the weight. It was an already overloaded ship and had more crew than it should have had. So when you add a few tons of ice, well, it makes the ship virtually unmanageable. You can't steer. You can't do anything. Another thing to remember about storms on the Great Lakes, they're very different than storms in the open ocean. In the ocean, you get big rollers. Not so in the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes has short, choppy waves. You hit one wave, you come down in the trough, and you hit another wave right away. And it makes it almost impossible to control a ship in that kind of violence. And so add all those factors together, and I'm sure the men were freezing. Absolutely freezing. So what happens to your hands when you start freezing? You can't do anything with your hands. I'm sure they couldn't hold on to the wheel or anything to save themselves. And they probably were all washed overboard mm-hmm. on one of the violent, waves that hit, and the bodies could be all over. Sorry to say.
These November gales, the captain certainly would have understood the risks of sailing at that time of the year and the possibility of encountering devastating storms like this one. Did he take precautions when planning their route to Chicago? Did he try to hug the shoreline, or was it more a matter of getting there as fast as possible?
Well, it's pretty much a direct route, almost a straight line from Manistique, Michigan, down to Chicago, Illinois. Yes, they weren't that far offshore by far. They probably weren't more than 5 or 6 miles offshore. They were pretty much following the shoreline. They could see the shore. And so they were never out of sight of land. But they left the harbor near Manistique thinking they could outrun the storm. They knew a storm was coming. That had been part of somebody's forecast. And so they knew it was coming. It was on its way. They thought they could beat it, and they couldn't.
And even though he knew there was a storm coming, he felt absolutely obligated to make that run. He had promised that they would have Christmas trees. His customers were waiting. His family was waiting. And he could not pay these men unless he got to Chicago and sold those trees. So it was imperative from a business point of view that he needed to get this run done because it would be the most profitable of his whole year. But also he had made promises and he wanted to keep those promises.
Yeah. Captain Shinneman had told his family that they would be back by Thanksgiving Day. They left Manistique area on the Friday before Thanksgiving, figuring, okay, we've got 6 days. It usually takes 3 days to run down to Chicago in a sailboat, so we've got a bit of leeway there. Well, the storm pretty much stopped them in their tracks. They were not quite halfway down to Chicago when they disappeared.
That's the thing about storms on the Great Lakes. They come up very suddenly, and they don't listen to the weather forecasters. They have their own idea.
Right. I mean, a popular saying here in the Great Lakes is, if you don't like the weather now, just wait 10 minutes.
So, as you've said, there have been 6,000 plus shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. Why is this one remembered over almost all of the others?
There are many reasons for it. First of all, everyone loves Christmas. It's a season of great joy and promise and hope. And yet there was this tragedy in the middle of this happy holiday season. And the tragedy happened because someone was trying to make Christmas for Chicagoans. And then what happened after the ship sank was the heroic nature of the captain's family, these brave women who were doing what men always did. It wasn't easy for them because they had no role models.
Up until the mid-1930s, the Shinneman family was involved in the selling of the continual selling of Christmas trees at the end of every year. And the Chicago newspapers certainly reported on that and reminded people of what happened to the Rouse Simmons in 1912. However, in the mid-1930s, when they stopped selling Christmas trees, the story went dormant for about 10 years. But after World War II, one of the Chicago newspapers printed a large story about the Rouse Simmons being a Christmas tree ship and what happened to it. And ever since then, it seems that other newspapers have jumped on the bandwagon and also report that story. And of course, the more it got reported, the more it branched off into other areas of the arts. Artists started doing paintings of the Rouse Simmons underway and in at the Clark Street dock. And songs were being written, have been written in the last 20 years about the Rouse Simmons. And people have written books. There have been several books written about the Rouse Simmons. Many of them are children's books. And so what started out as just, you know, annual newspapers stories really branched out into a wide field of the arts.
Well, excellent. Yeah, thank you for sharing the story of the Christmas tree ship. I was actually introduced to you by the narrator of the audio version of your book, Charles Huddleston, who has a really amazing voice, doesn't he?
He did an amazing job. He's excellent, reader. And he adds inflections, tonal inflections that show emotion. And he does an excellent job.
Yeah, he really did a wonderful job on the book. And we were so pleased that project happened. We were very glad about it. And he's a wonderful human being.
So you've written many books outside of the Christmas tree ship. Is there another book that you think listeners might especially enjoy?
Well, I have a particular favorite, and it's called The Wreck of the Griffin. And to me, the story of the Griffin is such an amazing piece of history. And it's a huge mystery. The Griffin is the most sought and the most found ship on the Great Lakes. Of course, as Chris mentioned earlier, it hasn't been proven that it's been found. However, everyone wants to be the one who finds it because it's been called the Holy Grail of Great Lake shipwrecks. And everyone wants to be the one who will make history. So that, I think that's a really, really strong book. And I'm very proud of it. It's a beautiful book and it's very, very complete.
Yeah.
Have you looked for the Griffin? Do you think you know where it is?
Oh,
well, we have some ideas. We have done some looking. There was, the TV series Expedition Unknown joined us for a search. Obviously, you'd have heard about it if we'd have found the Griffin. We did find a shipwreck, but it was something else. We're still hot on the trail. We think we're getting warmer. But, here in the Great Lakes, that's basically a spring, summer, and early fall activity is, going out looking for shipwrecks. You really don't stand much of a chance in the wintertime, usually, in December, January, February, March, of having any luck going out finding shipwrecks, because you can't get out there, for one thing, because of the ice. But yeah, we're looking forward to next summer. We're going to continue the quest to find the Holy Grail of the Great Lakes.
Of course, when you're looking for a ship that's been at the bottom of one of the lakes for 350 years, the trail is pretty cold. So it's very difficult.
You know, there were no survivors of that particular shipwreck. And so, you know, the saying, dead men tell no tales. We're trying to piece it together. I mean, there's enormous amount of conjecture, but that's all it is.
When the Rouse Simmons was found, there was a lot of media coverage of that. Kent Bell Richard found it
on John Steele's boat.
Yes.
And so those two guys were the first divers to visit the Rouse Simmons. That was in October of 1971, a long time ago. And the
pictures that they brought back and have been brought back since then, mm-hmm. you know, when divers dive on it, are amazing and will take your breath away. The Christmas trees are still there. The
skeletal remains of Christmas trees below deck.
Wow.
Yes.
Yep.
And it's such a sharp reminder of how tragic this was. And that's added to the legacy as well. The mm-hmm. legacy of this ship has also been kept alive in Chicago by a modern day Christmas tree ship. The Coast Guard brings trees to Chicago every winter on the Coast Guard cutter Mackinac. And it's so wonderful. It's for poor people. Their trees are distributed by the Salvation Army and some other groups. And so when you go there and it's the ship is just festooned with lights and with trees and the coasties are there, and it's a wonderful celebration and a wonderful tribute to the memory of that Christmas tree ship, the Rouse Simmons.
And that started, rekindled that tradition in Chicago in the year 2000. So this is clearly a new millennium rekindling of that traditional story that is more than 100 years old of the Rouse Simmons.
Oh, amazing. What a nice tribute to such a tragedy. It's pretty great that the legacy of the Rouse Simmons continues on. It's a special bit of Christmas history for Chicago.
They hold a ceremony at the beginning of every December when the Coast Guard ship brings a 1,000 Christmas trees to be distributed in Chicago. They hold a bit of a ceremony at a statue of a captain at the helm at Navy Pier. It's to remember not just the victims of the Rouse Simmons, but all sailors who have died on the Great Lakes. But specifically, it obviously the specific focus is on the Rouse Simmons and its crew.
Well, I've really enjoyed having you on. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We hope you have a wonderful holiday season, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks again to my guests, Joan Forsberg and Chris Cole. Their book is called The Christmas Tree Ship. And an extra thank you to Charles Huddleston, true crime audiobook narrator extraordinaire and friend of the show, who allowed me to use this Christmas music you hear at the beginning and end of this episode. It's taken from the audiobook I Want to Come Home Tonight by Troy Taylor, and narrated by Mr. Huddleston. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. Have a safe tomorrow.